Let's see. Are we recording this?
Sure.
Oh, okay. So there, it's going to take me a minute to figure out how to phrase this. There's the psychological healing and psychological growth that comes from the Dharma. And then there's the dharmic path that comes from the Dharma, right? So that early on, most people are meditating to reduce their stress, to feel less angry, feel less sad, things like that. And this path really just seems to keep going, at least as far as I've seen it. There's also this other path of seeing the three gates, seeing emptiness, of transforming your perception of everything. And what seems to be the going viewpoint among at least a lot of Buddhists is, look, if you get this Dharma path, don't worry about the psychological path. That if you truly are seeing non-self, impermanence, emptiness, this psychological stuff is a subset of that problem, and it will disappear. This hasn't been my experience at all. Mm-mm. And with my students, this hasn't been their experience at all either. okay, I'm glad to see you agreeing that the idea that some level of awakening will get rid of psychological problems isn't true, because it certainly doesn't seem to be. I wasn't clear if I was supposed to be giving a talk or asking a question, so I'm not sure if my voice is going to go up at the end or not.
We can have a dialogue.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'll have a dialogue.
So I guess my own experience was both with the Mahasi path and when I switched to doing your style of meditation, I was doing pretty well in the awakening side of the path, mm-hmm. and could give killer Dharma talks. But the psychological side was moving a lot slower than one might expect of somebody who was giving Dharma talks, you know. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe a question I could come up with is, I'm not quite there yet. Yeah, I mean, in terms of saying, okay, you're doing well with this one side over here, with being the infinite, you know, how do you get better at being like the guy wearing your socks right now? Are there different practices? Is it just keep going and one comes after the other? I guess my experience has been recently, the path has totally shifted into the psychological again.
Yeah.
That, you know, experiences where I have neat things to say about consciousness are getting pretty few and far between now, and experiences where I can talk more about anger and fear and why I used to do stupid things I'm now doing less of are becoming a little more common.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've just described it in a way that it's different than the way that I think of it. I think of it as a single path, and the first part of the path is really the psychological, and you move from that into the, let's call it the transcendental, okay? Rather than being two separate paths. But if you look at what happened, the Mahasi method that's become so popular here was developed in a culture that had been a Buddhist culture for, I'm not sure how long, but certainly more than 1,000 years. And everybody in that culture takes the precepts as children, and it's a much more uniformly Buddhist culture, and the expectations that people will at least live up to the precepts and have an understanding of Dharma is, you know, it's quite different than most Western cultures where we're much more individualistic and eclectic. And, you know, there's much more uniformity there. And so in Burma, Thailand, most people think of themselves as practicing Buddhists, even if they never meditate. And what they're practicing is right speech, right action, right livelihood. And the more literate and the more fortunate ones may have an opportunity to learn more of the Dharma. So in terms of the Eightfold Path, they totally neglect the meditation part. And but there is some of the wisdom part and a lot of the virtue part that is kind of built into the whole social structure and much more common. This neglect of the meditation path was not just amongst lay Buddhists, but extended into the monasteries. And it was in a very strong reaction to that, that the forest tradition brought back in meditation, and particularly the form of meditation that Mahasi took from the forest tradition and brought back into the monasteries, introduced to lay people, and established a tradition that all lay people would come and spend a few months or a year, usually early in their life, in the monastery. And sometimes people would go back repeatedly. Now, well, the relevance of all this is that that in a sense, some of the work was already being done on the psychological part of it. And most people were neglecting the transcendental part of it until a form of meditation that actually was reasonably successful was reintroduced and became widespread. And then in the 50s and 60s, you had, you know, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, you know, the whole list of these people that went and spent time there. And they brought this back. And, of course, what they emphasized was the secular, a secularized meditation portion of the Eightfold Path. And they neglected the rest of it largely, except for bringing up every now and then in their Dharma talks and writing some nice books about it. But in terms of, you know, and Jon Kabat-Zinn took over and ran with it and things like that. So I see it as a continuum. When somebody practices the Eightfold Path as a whole, they're doing the psychological work, and they need to do the psychological work first to really prepare the mind for insight and for insight and awakening. But now that's largely being neglected. It's let's leapfrog over all of that, and let's just do the meditation part. And it does inevitably bring about some psychological, you know, the purification part, but not that very much, and there's not that much emphasis on it, and it's not being supported by the practice of right speech, right action, right livelihood, or for that matter, the second of the Eightfold Path, right thought, right intention. And so I see it as all the same thing. You want to overcome the suffering in your life and your neurotic habit patterns and things like that. Well, ultimately, attachment to self and being ruled by craving are just another form of neurosis, right? It's really all the same thing. But if you want to jump straight into the realization of impermanence and no self and things like that, without doing all of this work on yourself beforehand, then what you're going to be is you're going to be a stream enterer who knows that you're ego self, that you are not your ego self, and that you realize impermanence and no self, but you haven't done anything really to deal with all of your neuroses, all of your unresolved psychological trauma, all of this other stuff, or you've only minimally dealt with it. Like the biggest, if you've been doing retreats, you know, the biggest of that will come up in the middle of a retreat, and you'll have to confront it and deal with it to some degree. But you've got a lot of stuff left that's unresolved. And a stream entrant hasn't overcome craving by any means. You know, they have, when craving leads them into extremes of suffering or unwholesome behavior, then their insight, then they experience the reawakening. But they've got a whole lot of unresolved stuff. And often it seems some of that stuff has to get worked through just in the process of achieving awakening, and that accounts for a lot of the dark night things. You've got to get through some of your neurosis just to get to the place where, you know, you can become a stream entrant. But you can certainly be a stream entrant and still have most of your psychological baggage there still left to deal with. And so really all you've done is you've just kind of skipped over a particular part and stage of practice. Are those people on the trail, or?
No, they're walking right behind here.
Okay. Yeah. You see what I'm saying? It's not really two paths. It's one path, but you're just kind of skipping over one. Or, well, the funny thing is that you have the MBSR and things like that, and they're focused really on nothing but getting over the worst part of your psychological stuff, and they're not concerned with the transcendental part at all. And then you've got Spirit Rock and IMS and things like that, and they're trying to do both, but they're putting a lot of the emphasis on the transcendental part. Let's get to be a stream entrant, you know. So I see it as one path that, you know, you're not really doing all of it. And it's completely normal for somebody to be a stream entrant, even having practiced the whole of the Eightfold Path, and not have resolved all of their psychological stuff. There's still work to do. But had they practiced the Eightfold Path as a whole, they'd certainly be much further along in that process than what we might find with some people today.
Can you talk about what spiritual bypassing is sort of about? I mean, that's... Yeah. It seems like that book was very important.
Right. It's funny. I read the book. I read it rather quickly. I think basically the idea of spiritual bypassing, as I understand it, and you can correct me, is that you really use your spirituality to avoid dealing with your psychological issues, to mask over them, to pretend they aren't there, to ignore them. You bury them inside, but you pretend to the world that, you know, you're beyond all that. You tell yourself that, you know, I have these spiritual realizations, and therefore I don't need to deal with that other stuff. I can just ignore it or repress it if it comes up, or so forth. That's basically the idea, isn't it? Of spiritual bypassing.
Well, It was
a very amazing book, and it was a very accurate description of what a lot of people do. What a lot of people do in, I think, every spiritual path or religion is, you know, there's a lot of people out there in the valley that are Mormons or Baptists or things like that, and they're doing the same thing. They are convincing themselves and convincing everyone around them that they are this highly religious person with this deep dedication to their faith, and that they've achieved a lot of personal spiritual growth, and they repress and suppress and ignore all of the psychological stuff they've never dealt with until, of course, something triggers it and brings it to the fore. But I really, what I'm saying is that dealing with your neurosis and your unresolved psychological trauma and emotional trauma is basically the same process. You're realizing that certain things aren't the way that you believe them to be, and certain ways of responding to them are not appropriate. And whether this is a behavior pattern that you learned as a child or an adolescent, or whether this is your belief that you're a separate self and you've got to get your happiness from everybody else, it's the same kind of thing. It is delusion that leads you to act out of emotions driven by craving and aversion.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. The way I was starting to think about it while you were talking is, like, of course the understanding of emptiness is a gradual process. Mm-hmm. And there's the top-down understanding of emptiness, which is transcendental insight. Yeah. And then there's the bottom-up, which is, oh, that angry response that I had is empty, and that need to lash out at somebody is empty. Mm-hmm. And the top down and the bottom up could conceivably meet at some point.
Yeah, right.
But even, you know, among people I know who've had, you know, quite a number of these transcendental types of experiences, things in their immediate emotional reality still look totally real and mm-hmm. solid and true and them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, if we could use a word karma to describe this, you know, in the Buddhist sense, that even though you may have had a realization of no self and impermanence and emptiness, if you haven't done anything about your accumulated karma that causes you to react with anger or fear or low self-esteem or whatever, those things, those karmas still exist, and they are still going to bear fruit in the future. Doctrinally, it's only the achievement of perfect and complete enlightenment that frees you from making any more karma, and even there, you still have to work out your past karma, right? Yeah. And so you can work out your past karma in a wholesome way. So you find yourself reacting angrily, and then you try to take some appropriate measures to replace that, the bad karma of having a tendency towards anger, with the good karma of having a predisposition towards patience and loving kindness and compassion. But it's still a kind of work that you have to do.
Can I say something? In a way, I was always very
role will.
It doesn't. Isn't it still? Yeah.
So, I was quite fascinated by Ram Dass and Timothy Leary, and their experiments with LSD, and the home, they had a home that Peggy Hitchcock had actually let them stay at, a large mansion somewhere on the East Coast, where there was an awful lot of meditation and experimentation with mind-altering substance going on. But Ram Dass described that lots of people had amazing understandings from their mind-altering substances, but what he saw was that the people were ready to kill each other in this home. Like they were, the ethical standards were not there. Everybody was very interested in, you know, this amazing experience. But the amazing experience, you would think that it would translate into loving kindness and caring and ethics, but it didn't. And so Ram Dass, you know, very much became a teacher of more than the experience. He was teaching, you know, heart opening. Now, Ram Dass to this day is still recommending to people that they try psilocybin mushrooms, and that he thinks that that's an important heart opening experience. But he also, at the same time, is recommending an ethical practice.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So you can just leave it on in case we use it again. There is kind of this popular myth, and I think it is gradually being eroded, that when somebody becomes awakened or enlightened, that instantaneously there's this total transformation. There is in certain very specific ways, but it's not a total across the board transformation. It's a transformation in particular ways. And it's a transformation that is extremely helpful in making the other changes. But the Buddha described the path as having four stages. You know, and I think that just that fact by itself says to you that there's a lot of different kinds of work that needs to be done. And there's a lot of work that is best done even before you reach that stage of having some really profound spiritual experience. Because otherwise, just like, you know, Nancy was saying, you can be a person who's had this incredible insight, but you can still be nasty and mean and hate the other people you live with. And so where have you gotten to, really, you know? Well, if you can, you know, if you really did have an insight, whether it was through psilocybin or whether it was through meditation, you can use that understanding to make it easier to do these other things. And I think just to put it in a more classical language, it's that, you know, even after you've had insight and achieved the first stage of awakening, you've still got a whole lot of karma to work through. And as you work through that karma, you'll work through the second, third, and finally the fourth stages. And, you know, in terms of the fourth stage and the fact that, you know, they say that even an arhat has karma that they will still experience the fruition of, and using the Buddhist definition of karma, not the Hindu reincarnation version of karma, where everything that happens to you, but rather who you are is your karma. It calls to mind, there was a study done, you may be familiar with it, Ken Wilber and Bill Williams and a few other people. They were one of the first people to go out and seek out people that they thought were arhats or appeared to be arhats, and they published a book on it. And one of the conclusions that they came to is that whatever idiosyncrasies, personality traits that a person had before they became an arhat were still present afterwards.
Often worse.
And often much stronger. So you are familiar with that, yeah. Yeah, often worse. But the thing is, as an arhat with wisdom and compassion, they're still there, but they don't manifest in the kind of way that they would in an unrealized person, you know. And Jack Kornfield, there was an issue a few years ago, well, quite a few years ago. There was an issue of the publication that they put out, you know, the one that's in kind of a tabloid form. Can't remember the name of it.
Inquiring Mind.
Inquiring Mind. It was an article in Inquiring Mind. And Jack Kornfield describes the way Ajahn Chah used to behave, you know. He was obviously loving, very dedicated to his students and dedicated to teaching them, but he'd scream and yell at people and lose his temper and kick the dog and stuff like that and smoke cigars and, you know, a lot of things that people wouldn't normally associate with an arhat. But on the whole, everything he did, he managed to do in a way that was ultimately beneficial for his students, well, for most of his students. There were some people that would go to Ajahn Chah's monastery and they'd stay there 2 weeks and they'd say, I'm out of here. This is not for me. You know. But that was their judgment rather than their coming to really know him.
Well, so. We'll all aim to be kind in the books we write about you.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I have to tell you, as I continue to practice this path, I keep discovering, on the one hand, I'd say, dimensions of myself or parts of my mind that have been compartmentalized and haven't been dealt with in the last 20 or 30 years of my practice that I need to deal with, or to put it another way, that no matter how far along I go in this practice and continue it, I still find that I have accumulated past karma that comes up that I have to deal with. And so hopefully it always manifests ultimately in a very good way. What I see happening, though, you know, going back to the original thing, if we see this as a continuum and people trying to focus on different parts of the continuum and ignore the others, that treating meditation just as a therapy works fine as long as somebody doesn't stick with it too rigorously for too long. It helps them with their PTSD, it helps them with their addiction problems, it helps them with, you know, their anger management and things like that. As long as, you know, they do a program in this and they continue it, but it now that it's helped them through that problem, they let it kind of fall away. But if they continue to practice it strenuously, or rigorously, not strenuously, if they continue to practice it rigorously, then it's going to start to bear some of the other fruits, and that, of course, is what Willoughby Britton is discovering. And they're not necessarily prepared for that at all. And the same thing is true of the ones that say, okay, I'm going to go meditate, I'm going to do this practice until I have insight into impermanence and I become a stream enterer. And they don't do any of the rest of the Eightfold Path practice. They treat it as just, you know, it's a beeline to insight. And what happens to them is, as they begin to have insight, a lot of their stuff comes to the surface. And so they have to deal with that before the insight can mature. In both of these cases, you end up with people having these prolonged periods of a lot of, they're very, very disturbed. It's difficult for them to function. It can go on for weeks or months or even years. They find it hard to meditate. Worst cases, amongst the things that Willoughby has documented are people that have had to be institutionalized and treated psychiatrically to deal with this. And of course, in the mildest cases are the people who go through a period where their life seems to have lost all meaning. They find it hard to meditate, and they're kind of stuck in a place where they may continue to be able to function. But Daniel Ingram talks about this in his book, and he says, when you're going through this, don't do anything. You know, don't make any decisions, don't take any actions. Do your best to let the stuff you're going through have the least possible impact on anybody else around you. And you can do that in the milder cases, you know. But I think that I really think following the Eightfold Path as a whole, rather than just pieces, and recognizing that you have to deal with your own karma as a part of that process, your karma being personality traits that you have that are unwholesome and undesirable, dealing with your own karma is as much a part of the process as achieving insight, and they are different parts of the same process, and they are functionally complementary, that each facilitates the other, so that if you work through your karma before you achieve insight, then the process of achieving insight and awakening is going to go much more easily and more smoothly. And then having done that, then as you move through first to second and third path and so forth, then finishing the process of working through your karma is going to be much, much easier because of that. So in that sense, there's a complementarity as well. But yeah, there's this expectation that it's magic. Okay, I'm a stream enter now. All my problems are over. Whoops. I'm a once returner. I'm not going to have any of those kind of problems anymore. Whoops.
Yeah, that there.
Oh, thank you.
That was a better way to pass it. There are certain things that are so, that appear so real, that all knowledge of emptiness, all insight in emptiness, just disappears when something that real shows up. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, of course, a factor of directly proportional to the amount of tana, the amount of craving or aversion to the thing that comes up. If you really want it or you really hate it, this knowledge that everything is empty just disappears for that particular thing. I was thinking about, so I teach the Sangha for people with mental illness, and there's this one older woman in it right now who's made among the best progress I've seen somebody make psychologically. She'd been a shut-in for many years, and depression and PTSD for 53 years, she told me.
Wow.
And she said, it's gone. She said, you know, I feel like I've been wasting my life on this depression and PTSD. I'm going to the park. I'm hanging out with little kids. She drove 30 miles by herself to see Bhante Gunaratna talk in Mesa. She got lost and didn't make it there, which was fine. It was a terrible talk, and it was. she had this great psychological experience of dealing with being lost far from home and having to stop and talk to people. And I had this miserable experience of sitting through this talk and dealing with the embarrassment of walking out early because I couldn't take it anymore. But in talking to her about how are you getting over these psychological problems you've had for over half a century, I didn't think of it at the time, but the way she's describing it is in terms of focusing on the breath is allowing her to see the emptiness. That she says, you know, the depression will come up, and I'll say to it, I'm very busy with the breath, do your thing back there, but I'm not going to pay any attention to you. Mm-hmm. And that ability to stabilize attention is allowing her to see that this thing that used to look real actually isn't, and then it just melts away. I hadn't thought of that before as the transcendental and the psychological actually being complementary sides of the same process, where enough of one, enough of either wouldn't necessarily affect the other side of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was.
Isn't it wonderful when you see somebody that's they've had something like that, and then once you know, I describe it as purification, but I also describe it as integration. Once whatever it was that launched that state of ongoing PTSD, which kept reinforcing itself for 52 years. Once you get to the 53, once the person is able to get to the root of that and let go of it and integrate it into who they are, it's like, it's magic. Well, shall we take a break and meditate? Thank you.